Hello and welcome to London by Guide. My name's Isabel and I'm an award-winning London Blue Badge tourist guide and city guide. During our lockdown due to coronavirus, I've been experimenting with some podcasting. And so I'm about to record and then I hope upload my latest episode. So in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about some women who feature in my walks. I have several walks in my repertoire which focus on women and the women's movement, but that doesn't mean I don't talk about women on other tours. Despite their absence from mainstream history, women have been actively shaping our world for as long as men have, so their stories belong on all walks. In the course of researching walks and tours, Janet Johnson stands out as one of the most remarkable people of whom you've probably never heard. Her work and reports on the care of deprived children led to the Children's Bill of 1948 and still impacts on policy today. Yet without a plaque in Red Cross Street in Southwark, it's unlikely I should ever have come across her story. She was born in 1858 and brought up in Oxford, where her father was an academic. It was in Oxford that she met Octavia Hill, the social reformer and founder of the National Trust. When Octavia Hill was working on social housing projects in North Southwark, Janet Johnson came to work alongside her in a neighbourhood known for criminality and poverty. Janet Johnson's interest in poor law administration grew out of this experience. She became the first woman guardian of the poor in Southwark. Concerned about high mortality rates among babies and infants in the workhouse, she moved into a local flat to keep an eye on things. Despite introducing improvements, she realised her efforts were only palliative, so next she managed to persuade the authorities to allow her to place babies born in the workhouse into the care of supervised foster mothers. In 1889, she became manager of the Central London District School for Orphans and Destitute Children. Unsurprisingly, she immediately set about instituting reforms in all areas. She wasn't universally popular. Some of her male colleagues evidently regarded her as a meddling woman, but Janet Johnson was not the sort of person who was going to let that stop her. Realising many of the boys were friendless, she persuaded her friends to write to them and to take them out on half-day holidays. I often think it must have been quite demanding to be Janet Johnson's friends. She had very high standards, which she expected all her friends to share. When the boys left school, they went to work in placements which seldom took into account their aptitudes and interests. Unsurprisingly, many of them failed. Janet Johnson wanted the boys' skills to be matched to jobs in skilled trades and apprenticeships, of them to be lodged with families who would treat them as family members. Again, she called on her friends to visit and to raise money so that the boys could study. Aged 60, she retired from her work with children, but took on war work. She loved to travel, ideally abroad, but she had become a trustee for the National Trust and so spent much of her time cycling to National Trust properties and going to visit boys who had relocated to the countryside. She died in 1955. Not all the women I talk about are as high-minded as Janet Johnson. These next definitely belong at the other end of the moral spectrum. The 40 Thieves, also known as the 40 Elephants, were Britain's first organised female crime syndicate, specialising in shoplifting. It's not clear when the 40 Elephants began. Some reckon they were established in the 18th century. Certainly they were known to the police by the late 19th century after they'd broken away from their controlling male relatives in the Elephant Gang, who specialised in housebreaking. Both gangs took their names from the district where they lived, the Elephant and Castle. Despite its central location, the Elephant has not traditionally been a wealthy area, and there are still many inhabitants who struggle to get by, while developers build luxury flats in the neighbourhood for those who can afford them. In the 19th century, many people at the Elephant struggled to survive on low pay and lived in overcrowded, unsanitary conditions with three or more families living in properties designed to house a single family. Then, as now, teenage girls began to take a greater interest in their appearance. They wanted to look good and to wear nice clothes. Their problem was a lack of funds. The easiest way to get new clothes was to steal them from nearby markets. Gradually a gang formed, and their leader was known as their queen. The gang members were usually related, and the queen was chosen for her skills in planning and executing shoplifting expeditions. She also needed to be able to look after herself in a fight. In 1890, the queen was called Mary Carr. She was so infamous, a play was written about her and performed both in London and on Broadway. The last queen was Shirley Pitts. When she died from cancer in 1992, she was buried in Tooting Cemetery, wearing a £5,000 Sandra Rhodes dress stolen from Harrods. I love the way Victorian organisations seem to revel in long titles. One of the earliest women's trades unions was called the Women's Grand Lodge of Operative Straw Platters, Servers, Bleachers and Blockers. Another, rather easier to remember, was the Bookbinders Union, which was part of the Women's Protective Provident League. As well as bookbinders, it represented artificial flower makers, shop workers and typists, jam and pickle workers, feather dressers and dressmakers. Hearing the list, you might think being an artificial flower maker could have been an agreeable occupation. In fact, that was far from being the case. Women employed in this role were often slowly poisoned by the arsenic used for the pretty green of the flower's leaves. There was also a passing fashion for frosting flowers with fine glass, which got into the women's lungs. Those women's names are largely forgotten, but some members of the same union did achieve fame and success. One such was Sarah Prideaux, bookbinder. She was born in 1853 and studied in London and Paris. She wrote extensively on her subject and produced bound books inspired by Art Nouveau patterns. She became a director of the Women's Printing Society, a publishing house which played an important role in the British suffrage movement, through both publishing feminist tracts and in providing employment opportunities for women in a field that had previously been the preserve of men. Sarah Prideaux didn't spend her whole life working. She also cycled, skied, and even bobsleighed. A woman who is also remembered with a plaque, this time in Westminster, was Eleanor Rathbone, who was born in Liverpool in 1872. Her achievements are simply too many to list here. She's chiefly remembered, when she's remembered at all, for campaigning for a family allowance to be paid directly to mothers. After university in Oxford, where she founded the Associated Prigs, a discussion society debating moral issues of the day, she became a social investigator and in 1897, parliamentary secretary of the Liverpool Women's Suffrage Society. Eleanor Rathbone was the first woman to be elected to the Liverpool City Council. She became prominent in public life. She fought to abolish slums, to improve education, wages and working hours. By 1919, she was president of the National Societies for Equal Citizenship, formerly the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies, and she was also a Justice of the Peace. It seems there was scarcely a good cause she did not embrace. But she wasn't simply someone who wanted to do good. Eleanor Rathbone was immensely capable, immensely clear-sighted, immensely intelligent. She warned in 1933 of the dangers posed by the National Socialists in Germany, and foreign affairs became a priority for her. She'd been elected a Member of Parliament, standing as an independent, in the Flapper election of 1929. There were then only 14 women members in the Commons, and she used her position to campaign on feminist colonial issues, challenging child marriage and women's franchise inequalities in two countries then ruled under British mandate, India and Palestine, and campaigning against female genital mutilation in Kenya. She was heavily involved in the rescue of refugees from the Basque Country and from Czechoslovakia, and established the Parliamentary Committee on Refugees in 1938 as a vehicle for her campaigns and efforts to rescue endangered Jews. She challenged ministers and led deputations, visited internment camps, and put down 80 parliamentary questions on internment alone, fighting for improved conditions and challenging the tribunal system. Her work as a social investigator had given her a close knowledge of working class life and what she believed to be the universal male desire to dominate, which showed itself most plainly in men's power over their wives and their children. It was for this reason that she proposed a family allowance paid directly to women. Frustrated at being opposed in the Commons by male colleagues, she wondered aloud that any woman wants to marry anybody. The family allowance was finally introduced in 1946, the year of her death. I'm going to finish with the story of a royal princess. Princess Louise was the sixth child and fourth daughter of Queen Victoria. She was born in 1848 and died in 1939. She was a talented artist and trained as a sculptor. You can still see works by her in Kensington Gardens and at the National Portrait Gallery. She was friends with Whistler, Millet, Rossetti, and George Eliot, and part of the aesthetic movement. Like her sisters, Princess Louise had learned to cook when she was a child. But unlike her sisters, this was a skill she enjoyed, and she continued to practice it for the rest of her life, happy to swap recipes with her friends. Unlike her mother, Princess Louise supported the feminist movement and became friends with Josephine Butler and Elizabeth Garrett Anderson. She was also in favour of greater higher educational opportunities. She was not quite in the usual mould of royal princesses, so perhaps it was inevitable that whispers of scandal began to follow her. The most persistent of these scandalous rumours was that she had had an illegitimate child when she was 18. This child was said to have been adopted by Frederick Locock, the son of Queen Victoria's obstetrician, and to have been given the name Henry. When Henry grew up and married, he told all his children that his mother was Princess Louise. However, there's no proof to back this up, and given that Louise was at court throughout the time of her supposed pregnancy, but no one noticed any change in her figure, it all seems rather unlikely. When the pubs reopen, you might like to visit one named after Princess Louise in Holborn. It's famed for its traditional Victorian interior, with its wood panelling and a series of booths around a central bar. There are also, as you might expect, references to Princess Louise in the photographs and pictures on the walls upstairs. That's all for today. Stay safe and keep well.